Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world. Spreading the news and information.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and welcome to Healing with Dr. Daniels. And tonight's topic is rising healthcare costs. Now, one thing that's always amazed me is how healthcare costs keep rising and rising and rising, despite the obvious evidence that healthcare is of absolutely no benefit in terms of improving people's health. So the question then is, what is it that's driving these healthcare cost increases? And I also had another premise that everyone out there is just about as bright as I am, that surely people must notice that the value of money spent on healthcare just didn't seem to really have a return. In other words, the more they spent on healthcare, it didn't seem to make them healthier. So, given this, how is it that people are submitting to healthcare in larger numbers and more money is being spent on healthcare? And obviously, of course, the money being spent on healthcare has to be spent by individuals one way or another. So those of you who've been listening for a while, you'll notice that I've been following this amount spent on healthcare for some time, and as early as 2012, determined that if a person in the United States earns $100,000 a year, literally $25,000 of that $100,000 is going towards health insurance premiums or taxes related to healthcare, whether that is Medicare taxes, whether it's property taxes that are funding a local medical clinic, whether it's state taxes that are funding Medicaid, but literally $25,000 of that person's income are going out the window for healthcare, one fashion or another. And so it's easy to say, well, you know, people are spending money on healthcare foolishly. They don't recognize the danger that health care represents, and they're ignorant. I said, you know, that doesn't really sit well with me. I really believe sincerely in my heart everyone else is just about as bright as I am. And so people must realize that this health care is harmful and is simply not worth paying for. So the question then is, if people realize that healthcare is harmful, if they realize that healthcare is not worth paying for, then how is it the healthcare costs keep going up and up and up all the time? So I say, you know what? there must be some kind of price manipulation going on here. Yes. So I went to Google, and I looked up the a graph of healthcare expenditures over time. And I took a look at that graph, and I said, okay, can we see any place in this graph where healthcare expenditures declined, where there was a wiggle in the curve where things seem to be declining? And can we correlate that with some type of action or event in the United States that altered this little squiggle? And sure enough, there was. Now, many of you know that I'm 60 years old, which means that I was born in 1957. So my understanding of events, if you want to call it that, pretty much began around the time of my, I would say my birth. And looking at historical perspective, also the time before my birth. In other words, I would look back and I would say, hey, you know, what happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago? So I usually go back not much more before 1900. So what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to take you on a journey through healthcare expenditures and times when the healthcare expenditures appeared to stagnate. In other words, where it, you know, there was no increase for a while, and then boom, suddenly there's an uptick, and see if we can take a look at just what happened. All right. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 major events in the history of the United States, and each one was preceded by stagnation of healthcare expenditures and followed by a tremendous uptick in healthcare expenditures. And so we're going to start with, 1952. And what happened in 1952? Well, first thing is what happened before 1952. So before 1952, healthcare costs were moderating and the rate of increase was slowing and really kind of a plateau in terms of healthcare costs. In 1952, the government, that would be the United States federal government, passed something called the Hill-Burton Act. What was the Hill-Burton Act? Well, the Hill-Burton Act took the money of all taxpayers in the United States and gave it to private citizens to build hospitals. I do mean gave it to them. Now, it was presented as a loan. So this money was being loaned to private citizens for the purpose of building hospitals all over the United States. Now, some of these hospitals were considered community-owned, and some were owned by, later owned by universities or conglomerates of people. But these hospitals were built, and the agreement was the government, the U.S. government, would put forth a 100% unsecured loan, read gift, for the purpose of building these hospitals. And once these hospitals were built, the hospitals only had the obligation to give out in free care an amount of free care equal to the amount the government had given them to build the hospital. And they could do this over any period of time. Of note, this happened in 1952. It's now 2017, and there are still hospitals that have not repaid that very small debt by giving out charity. But I digress. The real point here is in 1953, 54, 55, we saw an incredible upsurge in medical costs. And so what happened then is the hospital built all of these, I mean, the government built all of these hospitals, creating artificial demand. And people were admitted to hospitals. And again, I went to medical school 1979 to 83. So then there were, we call them old timers. These were doctors who'd been in practice for 20, 30 years. And they would talk to us, young medical students, whenever we could get access to them, about what happened in the so-called old days. And so in the old days, in 1952, when this big proliferation of hospitals happened, people were admitted to hospitals for juice therapy, you know, juices they could have made at home. All of a sudden, they start checking into the hospital, and the doctor would write a prescription for juicing. I'm not against juicing. That's not the point. The point is building these hospitals created a capacity, and then the hospitals filled up. So the creation of these hospitals is really unrelated to any particular health need, but something the government did, intervened to do, to create and boost this medical industrial complex for this particular industry. So you would think that this kind of cash infusion would be, well, phenomenal. I mean, that's a lot of cash to build this number of hospitals. Now, I tacked on to the Hill-Burton Act, which is how I found out about it, was the Hill-Burton Act 1952 was the reason that African Americans supposedly were allowed to receive medical care. So I tacked on to the act, oh, by the way, if you accept Hill-Burton's funds, then you have to agree to provide medical care at these hospitals for people who have brown skin. They didn't use African American. I think they used the word Negro back then. And so that was very interesting. So I was born in 57. My sister was born in 52. And she was born just as the act was passed. And so my mother went to the hospital to have her, thinking, of course, that it was okay, but it really wasn't okay. And they didn't expect to see a black lady show up at a hospital and have a baby. It was like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And the babies didn't get enough oxygen, and they're both mentally retarded. A little premature, too. But so that's how I remember the Hill-Burton Act stuck in my mind. So I said, well, Mom, you know, couldn't you go to the hospital? Well, kind of, sort of, not maybe, but really. So anyway, that's the Hill-Burton Act. So the Hill-Burton Act pumped incredible amounts of money into the healthcare system and was followed by a surge in healthcare consumption and an explosion in prices. Okay. Then in 1962-64, healthcare prices and consumption again stagnated. I guess with the Hill-Burton Act, everyone ran to the hospital. Oh, my God, these great big shiny buildings the government's built for us, only to find, we really aren't getting any healing from this. This is really not helping us. Like, we're not feeling the benefit. So people just said, forget it. You know, there's nothing to it. We're not going to bother with this stuff anymore. All this, you know, technology, these gizmos and things with flashing lights and bells and stuff and these procedures and surgeries. We really don't think much of this. And so what happened then is the government passed Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. And you guessed it, huge explosion, uptick, upsurge in the prices of healthcare. So I just want to mention that my show is about to get cut off. Supposedly I only have 1 minute left. I'm not sure what happened here. So I'll keep talking. You guys can catch the replay if it does cut me off. So what happened then is 1965, there's the Medicare and Medicaid Act. These acts were passed under the pretense that Medicaid, pregnant women and children of the poor were too ignorant and stupid to do at home what everyone else does at home, which is, of course, have a baby, and that they need medical intervention. So since everyone is doing these things at home without any problem at all, then the question was, well, why would anyone need this service? Well, the answer is, of course, because these people are poor. They're poor, they don't have money, and they're stupid, and so they need medical intervention. And this was really the birth here of prenatal care, because people were led to believe that there's these other people, ignorant people, stupid people, who couldn't just call over a girlfriend to help them have a baby. No. They needed professionals. They needed experts. Why? Because they were poor and because they were stupid. And so because the media, we'll call it the media, by this time was really full-blown in terms of shaping public opinion, they were able to effectively shape the opinion of working, responsible Americans about other Americans that maybe they hadn't met who would theoretically need these services like Medicaid. And then there's a Medicare program, 1965, where it's like, well, elderly people need health care. Elderly people are becoming broke, they're becoming bankrupt because of their medical services. And as you get older, everyone knows that you need more medical care and your medical bills get larger and larger and larger. And so then the public was sold on this concept that old people needed medical care. And it was still in the United States, and as late as 1979, when I went to medical school, you almost never saw a sick person who was under 65. People were so healthy because of the food they ate and because, of course, medical care was not that much perceived as a necessity but a luxury. And so this was a time when if you had money, the doctors would come to your house. If you didn't have money, then you would go to the doctor's office. And doctors volunteered and gave away their services pretty much for free. And so you really couldn't convince anybody between the ages of 5 and 65 that medical care was especially needed in 65 because everyone had a relative or somebody who could help them out, and calling on a doctor was considered generally pretty much a waste of time because the doctor did not have usually much to add beyond what your relative had already done. So Medicare passed by scaring people, intimidating them into thinking, oh my God, after 65, I'll need all this care. And I can certainly tell you about my relatives as to what happened to the ones who are over 65, is they were in excellent, excellent health. And they had absolutely no need of medical care until, of course, they died of natural causes between the ages of 90 and 100. And so this boogeyman of high end-of-life care, high cost end-of-life care, in 1965 was largely an illusion and a boogeyman. So it wasn't all of this technology and intervention. And the concept of the intensive care unit and of massive medical intervention was really not possible until the fulfillment of the Hill-Burton Act, where all these hospitals were built that could then intervene and charge lots of money for end-of-life care. But again, still in 1965, end-of-life care was not that big a deal. A lot of people chose to stay home and just die at home of old age. And there was also in 1965 the attitude of older people, people who were over, say, 75, that, hey, I've lived my life. It's been great. I really enjoyed it. I've accumulated a few nickels, not a lot, but a few. And my children, my grandchildren can just keep the money and bury me. I'm not going to go chase after cures that are not there. So this is 1965. And again, with Medicare, what did we get? We got incredible access to medical care for the elderly. This gave life to the whole end of, gave rise to the whole end-of-life death spiral, where in the last year of life, medical system literally tortured, mutilated, and ultimately killed a lot of people, and sent the bill to Uncle Sam, who cheerfully paid it. And then, of course, we had Medicaid, where now, with 1965, with all of this intervention for Medicaid, now we had the opportunity to start medicating or giving medicines to young poor kids, and again, expand this market for medicines for children. And this gave rise to a whole other wave of healthcare price increases. So now we have the children of the poor getting a tremendous amount of medical intervention. We still have the middle class when it came to kids not doing much. Why? Because kids are so healthy. It was a waste of time. And I remember my parents just scoffing at the foolishness of these parents buying health insurance for children. How stupid. Children don't need health insurance. They're so healthy. They're born healthy. They live healthy. And that sickness was considered to be a matter of decline over time as the person aged. So in 1965, the middle class largely saw no need for health care or health insurance, or health care for that matter, because one, they were very healthy, and two, if they wanted to pay, they would just pay out of pocket back then anywhere from $5 to $15 for health care. For a medical encounter. And the cost of healthcare absolutely exploded. It exploded. And then, 1981, I was in medical school, so I was there, had a front seat spectator position on this one. So here I was in 1981. Now, to put this in perspective, I entered medical school in 1979. I didn't know it. But I entered during an incredible downturn, a decline in people's use of medical services. People were very disillusioned by what they had seen or experienced by the care they received in Medicare and in Medicaid. And it was clear that the poor people with this care from Medicaid were not getting any healthier from it. So nobody was too keen on jumping into this. And again, people's consumption of healthcare was leveling off and even starting a slight decline. In fact, when I was in medical school, 1979, I looked around, especially 1980, I said, my God, there's just not enough sickness to go around. There is just not enough sickness to keep all of us people who are training here occupied. So this was a source of, as you might imagine, mild panic for me. It was mild for me because I didn't have any loans. All I had to do was think of a second job to get when, of course, nobody was sick. So, but lo and behold, 1981, there was an uptick in healthcare costs. All of a sudden, 1981, healthcare costs are rising and rising and rising. What do you think happened in 1980? In 1980, they identified AIDS. And I even say, the AIDS pandemic begins. and yes, this saved the healthcare industry from what would have been a decline. And also in 1981, that's when they came out with the vaccine for hepatitis B. And it was just off to the races. And it says, June 5th. AIDS pandemic begins when the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports an unusual cluster of pneumocystis pneumonia in 5 homosexual men in Los Angeles. So, this is so what happened then with AIDS? Was AIDS was a disease invented literally to salvage the medical industrial complex and take those medical costs and move them back up to create artificial demand. So if everyone receiving HIV therapy today, boom, blink, blink, was not receiving any, we'll call it care, or medical intervention, that would be an incredible economic drain for the medical industrial complex. Now, what else happened? Well, in the same year, 1980-81, was the first heart and lung transplant in Stanford. And this was absolutely monumental in giving a boost to the transplant industry, which, those of you who listen to my show, What's a Body Worth? You can see that the medical industrial complex receives over $10.4 million in revenue from a fully transplanted body. So if you now turn individuals into $10.4 million paychecks, you can see that you're going to experience a tremendous uptick in healthcare costs, let's call it medical industrial complex revenues. This is another issue. A lot of people say, well, healthcare costs are up, healthcare costs are up. No. In industry, revenues are up. These aren't costs. These are all revenues. These are all revenues. Somebody's making a lot of money. There's a lot of profit here. So what happened then is the government invented the AIDS epidemic. The next thing that happened was the first heart-lung transplant at Stanford University. And a lot of heart-lung transplants followed, of course. And so I entered medical practice. I graduated from medical school in 1983, totally secure at this point, that there would be a firm degree of demand for medical services. Now, I wasn't going into AIDS or transplant therapy. My classmates did all that, thank goodness. But that left more space for me, of course, in the primary care space because everyone vacated that. Nobody wanted to treat cold, hypertension, diabetes, arthritis. That was like, boring, not profitable enough. So literally all of my peers, classmates, deserted the ship, literally, so to speak, and went into AIDS, transplant therapy, and other lucrative specialties. And this went on for a while. So what happened was the medical care costs, again, exploded ahead of inflation and all other costs. And it just spiraled out of control. And they kept going up and up and up. And the government was just wringing their hands. And then we had, if you'll recall, Hillary and Bill were in the White House. And Hillary was charged with creating a national health insurance act or policy. And so it was on the basis of these spiraling, unaffordable healthcare prices that this happened. Now, another thing happened from 1979 to 83. When I entered medical school in 79, people paid for their medical services out of pocket. If they went to a doctor, they reached in their pocket and they hand them some cash and they would pay. Same with the hospital. But in 1982-83, as health care costs were spiraling upward, people were all of a sudden saying, whoa, I think I want insurance. I need insurance. And by 1984-83, when I graduated in 83, but in 84 I was still doing a residency, more and more people were covered by insurance. And people really seriously looked at health insurance as a necessary employment benefit because they perceived healthcare costs as something uncontrollable that was going up and up and up and could ruin them. And they wrongfully perceived insurance as a rescue for that. So healthcare costs spiraled out of control until finally in 1995, healthcare costs started leveling off. The growth slowed. And so healthcare costs slowed, and it was incredible. Drug reps were getting laid off. The economy was slowing. And people just stopped spending on healthcare. And so something had to happen to infuse cash into the medical industrial complex. And 1997, boom, it happened, and meow, healthcare costs again resumed their upward climb. And it was just ferocious this time. It was incendiary. It was like lighting a match to a tank of gasoline. What could it be? What happened? And this one I missed because I was working in my office practicing medicine. I didn't take insurance, so I didn't even notice really when this happened. It kind of came into my peripheral view, and I said, I'm going to dismiss this. This is nothing. But apparently this was huge, and this sent up the other spiral. So what happened? Remember before 1965 when they had Medicaid, the program for health care for poor children? Mm-hmm. And how that plus Medicare just really sent revenues for the industry through the roof? Well, 1997, the government said, another shot in the arm is needed. And what did they do? 1997, the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, which, of course, did anything but balance the budget, introduced two new major federal health care insurance programs, Part C of Medicare, which welcomed HMOs and managed care into the Medicare program, and even worse, SCHIP. And this was the Children's Health Insurance Plan. And this now meant that all children in families that are at or below 200% of the poverty line could get insurance. This is subsidized by the government. Now, so you can imagine how many people might be at or below the poverty line, right? Now you double that, and now you've basically taken the Medicaid program and you double, triple, quadrupled its size. But this is not under, some states chose to roll it into Medicaid. Others, most states like New York, took SCHIP and made it part of a private policy that these poor families could now buy for like $15 a month for their children. But what did this do? This took people, it put them into the health system, created a lot more health encounters, drug ingestion, hospitalizations, surgeries, things would never have happened. So it's literally manufactured demand, if you want to call it that, out of thin air. And so these so-called near-poor families receive this, we'll call it a benefit, not that it helped them at all, it didn't, but we'll call it a benefit. And what this meant, the government says, okay, you now have money, but you can only use this money for health care. You can only use this money for dangerous, mutilating, lethal intervention, and we're going to call it care. And so they changed the food stamp program, other federal programs, but this is the impetus for outrageous increase in revenues for the healthcare industry under a circumstance where people, had they been able to simply pull money out of their pocket and decide how to spend it, would never have decided to spend it on healthcare. They might have decided to spend it on better quality of food for the kids, maybe more heat for the house in Syracuse, so that the kids wouldn't get colds and wouldn't become sick from, not enough heat in the house, for example. So the government again intervenes on behalf of the medical industrial complex to give it a shot in the arm in 1997, when clearly people's confidence in the system was waning, people were turning away from the system, and people were declining to spend their money on health care or even health insurance for that matter. Now, along 1997, what also happened was there was a big immunization push. There's a lot more immunizations going on, which meant we had a lot more sick kids. And in my medical practice, I noticed that the kids who were immunized were tremendously ill. They had ear infections, they had bronchitis, they had asthma, they were just plain sick. And the ones who were not immunized were just healthy, just like the old-fashioned kids, very healthy, they needed no visits. See them once in kindergarten, and then you see them again with their pre-college physical, and that's it, nothing in between. They just simply did not get sick. And so in 1997, we have the SCHIP program, and again, healthcare costs just spiral up and up and up and out of control. And you have all these stories about people who couldn't afford their healthcare, and because they couldn't afford their healthcare, they couldn't see the doctor. But however, not one single case did it make a material difference in the person's health because they didn't receive health care. I mean, all the health care stories I've heard. Oh, my God, this person went to the hospital because they had chest pain. The chest pain evaluation was $20,000. Person had no insurance. They had to pay out of pocket. But wait. The hospital did not find a heart attack. There was no problem. If the person had not received any health care, they would still be healthy, but they would be $20,000 richer. So all of these tear-jerking stories about people not receiving health care because they didn't have money, it was clear that had they received the health care, it would not have made a material difference. Of course, this little detail was never noted by the person reporting on the story. And so healthcare revenues, revenues for the healthcare industry, again, spiraled out of control. Now, something else happened. I noticed this as soon as I got to medical school, that many decisions which were discretionary, lifestyle decisions, were all of a sudden reclassified as health decisions. And all of a sudden, this thing called healthcare started dominating more and more and more and more of a person's life. All of a sudden, it was a doctor's job to tell parents how to raise their children, whether they should spank them or not, whether they should tell them to do this or tell them to do that. All of a sudden, doctors were appointed as authorities. And authorities in areas where doctors couldn't possibly be authorities. Why? Because doctors, what do? They put off their child rearing until they finish their education. Have their first kid around 30, 35, right? So this is the person seriously unqualified to give any information at all. And the information they give, of course, is totally based on propaganda the government wants them to hand out and the government's social agenda, whatever it might be. So child rearing was a matter of medical supervision and intervention. Telling someone who their sex partner should be, who they should and shouldn't have sex with. With AIDS, oh my God, now the doctor's got total control. How many sex partners do you have? What are their names? Let's write them down. And this level of intrusion into a person's personal life and discretionary decisions. And so we now know, of course, it is difficult to catch AIDS sexually. You literally have to have sex with the same person at least 3,000 times. And then only one, you know, you might get AIDS from that person if the person's HIV positive. This is shocking when you stop to think that a lot of marriages don't last long enough for the people to have sex 3,000 times. So actually, if you have that information, and we had similar information in the 80s, casual sex is the only way to protect yourself from AIDS, right? Don't have sex with anyone that many times. However, we doctors were told to give people exactly the opposite information. Because there's AIDS, because there's this big chance of harm, the government needs to step in and tell people who to have sex with, how often to have sex, and on and on and on it goes. And, of course, the sexual advice, which is limit your lifetime partners to 3 sexual partners, didn't comport with the data. The data being that in order to transmit AIDS to somebody heterosexually, it takes incredible effort. And sticking around with someone for a longer period of time just means that if they are HIV positive, that you're more likely to get it. Now, again, of course, nobody wanted to be tested for AIDS. Because once you're tested for AIDS, well, that's pretty much the end of any kind of upward social mobility you might have. So we now had the medicalization of normal functions. So all of a sudden, we doctors were told that parents should allow their children so much TV time. We were told parents should allow their children to eat pretty much anything that the food industry produced, and you shouldn't be fanatical about, you know, changing your child's diet. That up until age 5, a child's diet is very important and certainly determined his health. But after age 5, the health of human beings was not determined by their diet, and we should tell people to not be superstitious and don't limit their intakes of certain types of foods. And so then I found people had needed me to write a prescription for hearing aid batteries. They needed me to write a prescription for tape so they could tape a bandage on. So all these expenses that really were not medical expenses were all of a sudden under the control of the doctor, under control of the prescription pad. Why? Because they were covered or paid for by the government. So now the individual needed the permission of a government representative that would be a licensed doctor, that's me, to consume these things. And many of these things were actually just ordinary purchases. And it didn't seem to me to make any sense to convert these expenditures into a medical issue. I even was writing notes for people to get certain types of housing paid for by the government. And so what was happening then was what we had was a serious, incredible fascism where the government was taxing people, taking all of their money, and then telling them, you can live here and not there. You can use this kind of tape for your bandages and not that kind of tape. You can have batteries for your hearing aids, but only so much and so often, rather than leaving people to simply keep their money and make these decisions on their own. And so we had this big intrusion of the government making all these decisions for people. And so what I realized in the 90s, that this idea of healthcare costs, and I'm telling you, it's not a cost, it's very real, it's a revenue, it's a profit, increasing, was not a problem. The goal was to have these costs increase as much as possible to ultimately give the government a pretense for instituting a 100% tax and telling people literally what color clothes they should wear, where they were, when they should vacation, where they should live, what kind of house they should live in, if they can eat food and how much food they could eat, if they can have sex and who they should have sex with. And so all of these decisions were becoming medical decisions. And of course, we had the increase in revenue to go along with it. But the public got a little tired of this. Or what really happened was we had the crash in 08. Thank God for the crash in 08. Why would we thank God for the crash in 08? Well, when the crash in 08 came, people said, wait a minute. My income is falling. I ought to cut back somewhere. And guess where they decided to cut back? They decided to cut back on their health insurance. People dropped their health insurance. And guess what happened when they dropped their health insurance? They dropped their health insurance, and they didn't get sick, and they didn't spend money on health insurance, and they didn't spend money on the medical industrial complex. Or even better, maybe they got sick, stayed home, but got better all by themselves. Or maybe they drank a glass of water. Never know. But they got better. So the death rate didn't notice any blip in the death rate, but there was a dip in healthcare revenues. So healthcare revenues show a little nick, and you look at the graph, there's a little nick right there at 09. And so what happened in 09? Emergency cash infusion. The Obamacare Act passes in 09. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was passed in the Senate on December 09 and passed in the House on March 2010. Signed into law March 23rd, 2010, upheld in the Supreme Court on June 28th, 2012. And so it was passed in 09, and we saw the economic results in 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15 in the increasing rise in healthcare costs. And so we have then the Obamacare Act called Patient Protection and Affordable Act. When actually what happened is the patients were not protected. It was the Patient Exploitation and Exorbitant Care Act. And so what did we see? We saw healthcare premiums just absolutely skyrocket once people were compelled, forced by law, to take out health insurance. And so if history is our guide, then we can see that 97 needs a shot in the arm, and 13 years later, or 12 years later, another shot in the arm. So 1997 to 2009. So really, 97 to 08, people said, whoa, wait a minute, healthcare has got to go. If we're going to make the mortgage payment, we got to stop paying for healthcare. We've got to stop paying for health insurance premiums. And they just threw the medical industrial complex overboard. You know, as I say, threw them under the bus. And so the healthcare industry went straight to Congress and says, hey, you guys, you got to bail us out here. They said, okay, we'll do a bail-in. We're going to institute a supplemental tax, an unfunded mandate by compelling people to buy insurance but not giving them any federal dollars to buy the insurance with. And so they already went through the nonsense with Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, and I think people were not ready, or probably would not have accepted, a doubling of Medicaid taxes or Medicare taxes. And so, okay, we have to find another way. And so what they do, they compel people to buy health insurance, which gave the healthcare industry a big financial shot in the arm. And so what has happened? Well, so 2012, things were upheld. So 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, 16. So it's now 2017, and somebody has taken a look, and they have noticed that, oops, I want to say oops, maybe it's hooray, but the life expectancy in the United States is declining. Yep, it's declining. So life expectancy in the United States is declining, and we are now spending more than ever on health insurance. And the revenues for the industry that's supposedly keeping United States citizens healthy have never been higher. So if health insurance creates health care, and if health care has a meaningful impact on health, then if we increase our health care, we have to accept that whatever change we see in health must be due to the health care. Okay, so it's clear health care consumption has definitely increased. More people are using emergency rooms. More people are going to hospitals. More people are keeping doctor's appointments. And now we find life expectancy is declining. Then logically, if we're going to go along this line of logic, the health care is seriously is shortening people's life expectancy and is killing people. So this life expectancy, decline in life expectancy, is across the board, from birth all the way over to death. So in other words, children are dying in increased numbers. Now, you may be pro-vaccine, you may be against vaccine, but one thing we can say for sure is the vaccines are not creating healthy children. So even though kids are now getting more vaccines than ever, the death rate among children, natural causes, is going up. The autism rate is going up. And so the vaccines are not helping the children live longer. In fact, they are having a lower life expectancy. And I just had a nephew, just had a baby 2 days ago. His wife went to prenatal care, did everything she was told, and now they have a baby with hydrocephalus, needs brain surgery. If prenatal care was so great, how come the baby's so awful? So, in summary, then, every single increase in health care has been preceded by 6 to 12 months by a policy change of the government to literally create and pump more money into the healthcare industry. So healthcare increases are not an accident. They are engineered. This is market manipulation of the industry, intervention of the government big time. And this is why healthcare costs are rising. And they're going to continue to rise if every time the government steps in and pumps money into an industry where citizens themselves have decided they don't want to pump their personal dollars into this industry. And so this is really an outrageous deployment of funds. This represents really grand robbery, larceny, if you will, on a multi-trillion dollar scale. Healthcare costs in the United States are preparing to top $4 trillion. This is a lot of money. So if you take away the Medicare program, which is killing at least 180,000 people a year, and this is an admission made by Dr. Levinson, the Inspector General for Medicare, in 2012, he says, oh, we're only killing 180,000 people a year. I guess it wasn't enough people because there were no charges filed and no investigations done. And then we have Medicaid presiding over the creation of the sickest generation of children ever. You know, these programs were just stopped tomorrow. I believe more Americans would live longer and healthier. There's just absolutely no question about it. And the Hill-Burton Act, major travesty to build all these hospitals, to create all these intensive care units. Intensive care units, if you didn't know, have a death rate of 15.7%. That's a 15.7% kill rate over a period of 10 days. That's incredible. Wars don't have as big a kill rate as that. So you have the Hill-Burton Act, Medicare, Medicaid Act. Then you have the creation of AIDS. And we know the AIDS deaths are due in large part to the drugs. So we have a 11,000 death rate there, but even more importantly is the revenue to the industry. Then you have the CHIP program, which is simply a vehicle to compel immunizations because now, of course, the kid has insurance, right? And then, of course, you have Obamacare. So all of these things simply create an incredible infusion of cash from an industry whose harm in health is absolutely obvious. All right, we have 10 minutes left, and so we have time for some questions. I'm guessing somebody is able to hear me, so let me go to the chat room and see what's going on here. Okay. All right, let's see. Definitely answers. Things from things like bees, spiders, scorpions. If no turpentine is around the house, it would be safe to also use household ammonia. I don't have familiarity with household ammonia, so I can't really comment on that. So I can say that you've got plenty of time to get turpentine and just do that. Wonderful. So very interesting and welcome side benefit of starting turpentine with Candida Cleaner instructions, the PDF. By the way, go to vitalitycapsules.com and get your free copy of the Candida Cleaner. It is the updated version. I have spastic cerebral palsy, which mostly affects my walk. To my amazement, I am experiencing a subtle and noticeable increase in flexibility in my legs, feet, hips, and so on. Dr. Daniels won't mind perhaps commenting on that. Yes. So cerebral palsy is caused in the second trimester by a parasitic infection of the mother, and it spread to the baby. Now, this is my opinion only. How do I get to this opinion? So when I was in medical school back in 79, if a baby had cerebral palsy, it was the doctor's fault. Oh, bad delivery, blah, 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 should have done a C-section, which, of course, was not true. Then they did more research and took a look at it, and they found the cerebral palsy happened in the second trimester independent of any delivery method, whatever. And it had nothing to do with the doctor. So you could not possibly prevent cerebral palsy by getting prenatal care. This was a big blow to the medical profession because what they needed in order to really exploit pregnant ladies was to convince women that they could only have healthy babies by going to the doctor and that having prenatal care made a difference. And so as early as 83, it was determined that there was an event in the second trimester that caused cerebral palsy. And obviously the event is a parasitic infection. No, we don't know which parasite. The doctors don't look that close. Okay, let's see. Okay, so people are still on the line. You can click your button there and might answer questions. I'm looking here. I feel like if they only offered emergency care, then they could cover everyone without paying taxes, but they can't make money. Exactly. It's all about making money for the industry. The medical industrial complex is just like the military industrial complex. So if you put medical in front of something, you can literally increase the price tenfold. If it's not for a medical purpose, just regular everyday stuff, then the price goes way down. So this is all about the government creating monopolies and being able to sell, to create revenue streams for their cronies. Okay. All right. I'm a musician. Okay. All right. I'm a musician, and I had a gig about 4 years ago. I met another musician who told me he had a job for 20 years as an audio engineer who inserted subliminal audio into TV commercials. I asked him what type of command he inserted. He said short 2 or 3 word commands. I asked him if there was any way to pull the commands out of the audio to hear what they were. He said no. Once they were buried into the lower frequencies, there's no way with available technology to pull them out. They started with the TV commercials in the 80s, if I remember correctly. I will lay a $5 wager that subliminal audio was inserted into all those commercials with the command, trust your doctor or ask your doctor. And the answer is absolutely. I became aware of this subliminal situation in after 2000. So after I lost my license, I started mixing more with regular people, and I met a sound engineer at a cocktail party, and he told me exactly the same thing. In fact, he was hired to not only use subliminal messages at concerts, but also to spray different scents that would cause the crowd to behave in a certain way. And so, yes, really, the amount of MK Ultra mind control going on out there is such a high level that your only defense is to turn off the TV. Turn off the TV and probably even the YouTube videos as much as possible. But you just need to know that there are people who are paying an incredible sum of money to influence your behavior, and it's all around you. And unfortunately, the only defense is to limit the input. Okay. Just for me, says, I'm 77 female. My balance is off. How can I correct this? Is it vertical? No, it is not vertical. Vertical is when the room spins. You stand still, the room spins. If you're 77-year-old female and your balance is off, I can tell you right now, your problem is that a lack of strength. I'm not an exercise fan. I don't like lifting weights, but that's what you need. So you need to literally go to the gym and lift weights. Or if you don't want to go to the gym and lift weights, just get some jugs or liquid water or whatever and practice lifting weights, doing leg extensions, and maybe hold on to the back of the couch and do squats and use your hands to pull yourself back up. But the answer to your balance problem is exercise. That is it. So Dr. Dance, I cannot wait to call my mother and tell her cerebral palsy was never her fault. Well, of course, then she'll say, well, I had that parasite. I didn't get it treated, but the doctors weren't going to treat it anyway. It's really nothing that she could have known about. You know, maybe if she'd taken her turpentine before conceiving, who knows? Okay, we only have 2 minutes left. Sorry, I can't get to all the questions on the chat room site here. I hope you've enjoyed the program, and definitely tune in for next week. Of course, Think definitely happens. I also want to remind people I have one spot left for my Panama program, where I'm teaching people how to heal themselves and how to avoid the medical industrial complex, because that is truly your only hope. Any engagement, any contact can only end poorly. All right, so contact Shalee, S-H-A-L-E-E, Shalee, S-H-A-L-E-E, at vitalitycapsules.com. We'll get some information out to you and see if you're the lucky one to get the last spot. All right. Thank you. Whoops. There we go.